You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. In 2018, Democrat T.J. Cox narrowly beat the Republican incumbent David Valadao to represent the 21st Congressional District. Now Valadao is campaigning to take that seat back. He joined me in the studio. We started our discussion on the topic of health care.
Well, so I've always supported pre-existing conditions. That's obviously something that's very important for all of us. But when I say market-based, I think that's only one component of it. And that's the problem that we get when we get into healthcare, is because it's such a complicated maze of topics. I mean, you get down into Bakersfield, for example, with three hospitals in the community there, and each one kind of has its target audience. And then if one person walks into the door because they're injured and they don't fit that demographic, sometimes they get dinged for it, and it actually puts a hospital at a disadvantage and actually puts them in financial danger. And we've had a problem here in the Central Valley, communities like Kalinga, communities like Tulare, California, who've actually lost their hospitals. And so when I look at a market-based approach, it's a lot higher level than that, just because we obviously want to take care of the folks who need it most. And that's why Medicaid, Medi-Cal was created, was to help people that who need it most, obviously our elderly, our disabled, our children, our mothers. And it's fine. It's good to protect that, and we need to make sure of that. But we also have to look at how we can find ways to lower health insurance costs, because we want employers to be able to afford to purchase health insurance for their employees, but we also want people who go out and start their own business to be able to afford to buy health insurance. And the problem is if you leave a job working for a company that employs 1,000 people, they're getting a much lower rate than you as an individual buying. And if you look at things like Obamacare that was supposed to keep prices lower, one of the things I heard from a lot of different folks when the Affordable Care Act came into play was, oh, I was expecting it to be a lot cheaper. And so they start looking for ways. Employees start to ask employers, and not employees, but people who have jobs working as odd jobs, hair salons, cash-based jobs, things like that. They start looking for ways to lower their income on paper so that they can qualify for Medicaid instead of playing a role in the system. And so what that means is we've got a high-cost system that we've got to find a way to lower those costs. And so one of the proposals that was in that legislation that we ended up voting for at the end there that got a lot of controversial comments on was it actually created a system that for health insurance companies, when they have someone with, let's say, cancer, a really expensive disease to treat, they would have the ability to lean on the government to help cover those costs so they wouldn't have to spread those costs among all the other insurees. And that the reason why was is if we keep those insurance rates low enough that everyone participates and they're able to make those leaps from the programs like Medi-Cal or Medicaid into the healthcare system to private insurance, it would be good for all of us. And the reason why that I felt that was important is here in the Central Valley, we struggle. We struggle with enough healthcare facilities. We struggle with bringing doctors. We struggle with bringing specialists. Fresno's not quite the same, but Fresno's not really in the district I'm looking to represent. But if you go out into the rural communities, into the Kalingas and the Avenels and Lost Hills, mostly clinics are going in there, not individual doctors and not really specialists. The reason why is because it's usually off of some sort of reimbursement rate from the government and from one of the programs. We've got to find ways to change that. And so during that whole negotiation with that health care bill, one of the things that I'd been working on was with our Secretary of Health and Human Services at the time, was to actually create a pilot project here in the Central Valley to look at reimbursement rates under those programs. And that would be in conjunction with finding ways to lower insurance rates for those who have insurance. And if we can lower those costs on both sides, it would help us find ways to obviously the reimbursement, bring doctors in on the reimbursement side, hopefully bring in specialists, expand our access to care here in the Central Valley, but also when people make that leap to the next level and hopefully people's lives get better, they're improved, they have the ability to do more, the insurance rates being low enough that they can make that jump, and it's not something that will literally put them out of house and home.
So I want to move on to education. What role do you believe the federal government should play in public education systems, which traditionally are led at the local and state level?
So I'm not a fan of the federal level playing a big role. I supported the plan to get rid of No Child Left Behind and put it back in local control. The problem with the state of California is such a big state. It still doesn't feel local. And when you go local in a state like Wyoming with 700,000 people, Wyoming's the size of Fresno County. I mean, it's just not the same thing. And so I like getting closer to the people as possible. But unfortunately, when you do something from the federal to the state, when it comes to the state, it still gets to be difficult. But I've always liked local control. I believe that a parent, a teacher, should be able to go to the people making the decision in their own community and be able to talk to those people on a regular basis. I think that federal government has enough going on, too. I mean, we've got so many issues that we need to deal with. We probably shouldn't be putting that decision so far away from home, but also in the hands of people who have a lot of other things going on too. And because we've struggled so long and so much here in the Central Valley and other parts of the country on health, on education, I was a big believer in that, and that's why I supported the plan to bring it back to the local level.
So you are the son of immigrants, and I'd like to know your thoughts about the current state of immigration in America, specifically about what's happened around separation of families.
So I don't support the separation of families, and I think that was a problem that needed to be resolved faster, but there's a lot of different factors that play into that. I've always been a supporter of fixing our immigration system. I was one of the few Republicans that signed on to a discharge petition where I took on my own party and my own leadership and forced a vote on the House floor to move some legislation forward. And I was also one of the few Republicans that signed on to the DREAM Act to help get that legislation moving forward. So I've always been a proud supporter of immigration reform. I've supported pathway to citizenship for people who are here, especially children here came here no fault of their own. But immigration in general, I've always felt we've got to do a few different things. One, we've got to make sure we know who's coming and going into our country. Two, we have to have look into the system we've got for allowing people to come in here legally who want to immigrate and actually live here. And I also think we need to work on our guest worker programs, because there are people who don't want to move here. They just want to work here for a short amount of time and go back to their countries, which they love and appreciate. And we're failing on all those fronts right now.
So late last year, Congressman Cox unveiled a $100 million proposal to give hundreds of rural communities in the Central Valley access to clean water. What was your take on that bill?
So there's a lot of programs out there for access to water to communities throughout the Central Valley. One of the things that we struggle with is there's always a category for a community that they don't fit into. And so the approach I've taken in the past when there was a community that was struggling to get those dollars was I would make changes to the existing program so that we can find ways to get those dollars into those communities. There's always more programs, and there's always more communities that are in need. And as our standards get tougher and tougher to meet, those numbers are going to continue to grow. And I mean, as far as looking for more avenues, more opportunities, I support that. But we also have to look at the underlying issue here is bringing more water into the Central Valley. I mean, to say I'm for clean water but not for bringing water in, what water are you going to clean to put in the system? And I think that's important to also look at that and actually pass legislation that does that. We did that when I passed the WIN Act, and some of the congressman's legislation actually is based off of or taking some of the work that I had done and taking advantage of that and using that to help the community. So a lot of that actually starts from me. But the WIN Act was something that I got passed, signed into law, and was a part of. But we also have more to do. And so I still think we have to continue to bring more water to the Central Valley. And that helps us put us in a position where we can deliver clean water to communities.
Okay, well, let's move on to renewable energy. You know, sources like solar and hydropower are becoming more and more common. Do you see the expansion of those forms of energy as potentially threatening the natural gas and oil industries, which, of course, are particularly of importance in Kern County?
No, I think I've always been an all-of-the-above guy. And so the market decides, and I think there's opportunity for everyone. We personally have put solar in on our facility. It made sense for us. Energy prices have gotten so high, and we do use electricity. And so it made sense for us to put in about a megawatt of power out there. I'm thrilled to have it out there. We're in the process of also putting in a methane digester to inject methane into the natural gas pipeline. And that's something that's going to be beneficial for us and our community and for our environment. But a lot of that isn't feasible without government dollars. I mean, solar is getting to the point where the cost is lowered, and the government played a role in helping those programs expand and to the technology to get better, but it does get to a point where they need to back away and allow the market to make those decisions. And a lot of these things are starting to work out, and they are more efficient, they are better for the environment, and it helps our communities in a lot of different fronts. And so I've always been an all-above guy that supports all the energy sources, but I just want to make sure that we do it in a way that's doesn't hurt the average family. We don't want to make it too expensive for them to drive to town or drive their kids to school. I don't want to make it so expensive that they can't turn on their air conditioning when it's 110 degrees. We've got to make sure we find ways to keep families comfortable and keep businesses successful here.
So just want to offer up the opportunity for you to make any comment about the lawsuit that has been waged against your family farm.
So in my role in Congress, I was required, House ethics rules required that I stood back and got away from the day-to-day operations. So I really feel sorry for the gentleman that was injured on that. But you also have to understand that because of my role in Congress and my requirement that I do not take any day, I wasn't there for him to be hired. I wasn't there during the training process, and I wasn't there when he was hurt. And so I really do wish him the best. but it's really outside of anything that I have the ability to really talk about.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Now let's hear from Valadao's opponent in the race to represent the 21st Congressional District, incumbent Democrat T.J. Cox. He was in Washington, D.C. when we spoke by phone. He started the conversation by sharing his impression of the impeachment hearing of President Trump.
Well, it was very moving to listen to so many of the dedicated civil servants, the Foreign Service officers, the National Security Agency officers, you know, who knew that there was something wrong with this administration and the president asking for a foreign government to interfere with our elections. Obviously, that was a very, very, very distressing time. It was really kind of a constitutional crisis. But, you know, in the midst of all that, I came to my office and certainly my colleagues, we're still working to get things done for the people that we represent. And, you know, to do the things each and every day that are going to make a positive difference in their lives.
So access to quality health care is obviously limited for residents in many rural communities in the Valley. You have campaigned on your work to secure funding for clinics in small communities like Fowler, Parlier, and Mendota. These clinics do obviously increase primary care services, but for people who are being treated by specialists, the issue of access remains. To that end, how do you propose coming to a long-term comprehensive solution to the access issue for healthcare in rural areas?
Well, access to quality, affordable healthcare is one of the primary reasons why I ran for Congress. As you're quite stated, that's why, one of the reasons why, that's what I was doing before I was in Congress. You know, I can go up and down the 99 and point to the health clinics that I actually had a hand in developing and funding, you know, creating, once again, healthcare access and quality, quality healthcare jobs for some of the people in the 21st. And that's what we continue to do in Congress. We're trying to bring down the cost of prescription drugs. You know, we're trying to promote telehealth. We've got a number of bills that we're addressing asthma and diabetes and valley fever. And so it's something that we know we can get to, which is quality, affordable healthcare for all.
All right, let's move on to education. What role do you believe the federal government should play in public education?
Well, you need two things to be successful in life. You need good health, and you need good education. Those are the building blocks for success here in our country and in every other country. And so, you know, just your primary education is no longer good enough to be able to compete in today's workforce. You need secondary education. And so we should be funding these things that are going to help our young men and women compete in the global economy going forward. And so we've introduced here a couple of things, an Inspires Act, which is basically funding facilities that are going to promote STEM education. We're working on the College Affordability Act and the Higher Education Act. Education is one of those investments that really pays for itself, and it's something that the federal government needs to be working with the state and local governments much more on and making sure that we have these investments that are going to pay off in the future.
Can you give me more specifics? I mean, there have been a lot of proposals, obviously, in the Democratic presidential campaign around making schools, free for all. What do you think about proposals like that?
Well, those are good investments that are actually going to pay off. If you look at there's no better investment than education, because you're going to get a quality, trained employee that's going to pay taxes. They're going to be very successful, for themselves, their family, and their communities. And so, funding more things like the facilities themselves, making sure that that people can afford to go to college by bringing down the cost of education and have more public loan forgiveness, more Pell grants, and particularly also Pell grants for, so many of our Dreamers that are contributing so much. Once again, investment into education is one of the best things that we can do. And certainly, we're also talking about investments in more technical education, because you see, in our growing economy, there's such a demand for the trade skills, for for the welders and for the operators and those types, and the electricians and plumbers and so on.
So you mentioned Dreamers or DACA recipients. Let's move on to immigration. You've called for common sense immigration reforms. What do you mean by that? And how would your work in Washington, D.C. on behalf of bringing common sense immigration differ from your opponent?
Well, you may know I'm the son of, a couple of hardworking immigrants. My dad came from China, my mom from the Philippines, and they really lived in the American dream. But the other day, I can tell you, I was out at a grape harvest, and I was talking to a young man. He was undocumented, and he takes care of his brothers and sisters. And before he works in the fields in the morning, he goes to community college in the afternoon and works another job at night. Before he leaves in the morning, he has to tell his brothers and sisters, don't be afraid if I don't come home. And, you know, because he's afraid about getting picked up, you know, for what? For trying to improve himself and help out his family. And so we need to have a common sense immigration policy that provides for a workforce now, make sure that anybody here is here legally and certainly doesn't break apart families, and it's going to meet the needs for our country going forward. And that's why I was very happy to preside over the vote for the Farm Worker Modernization Act, which provides basically a workforce visa for ag workers, and also to be able to, you know, cast a vote for the Dream and Cross Act, provide a pathway to citizenship for so many of our Dreamers and DACA recipients.
So last year, you unveiled the Disadvantaged Community Drinking Water Assistance Act, which was a $100 million bill to give hundreds of rural communities in the Central Valley access to clean water. Critics say your proposal is duplicative of the existing Safe Water Drinking Act and could potentially create more red tape and bureaucracy. What is your response?
Well, you know, as an engineer, I like to build things. And this is what we did to craft that bill. We went out to all the communities to ask them what their needs were and just find out where the gaps were. So we found out, you know, many towns are too large in terms of population to qualify for most of those types of grants, available grant programs. And we found out that the ones that were able to qualify for them, they don't have enough of a taxpayer base to be able to pay back some of these revolving type of funds, or they didn't have the technical assistance to actually write those grants. And so this is a bill that was crafted with stakeholders in mind, and we actually brought out the chairman of the Natural Resources Committee to be able to speak to a number of these stakeholders and actually to see the need for this bill with his own two eyes. And that's why he was chairperson or a co-sponsor of this bill as well. But this is a bill that was critically needed by so many of our communities. And with their input, we drafted this bill. And I'm happy to say it's actually been heard in Congress. It was voted out of committee and is going to the floor for a full vote.
Okay. So I'd like to talk a bit about Kern County specifically. The oil industry there has been vocal in its concern over potential plans by the state to limit oil production in California. Now, this is a state issue, not a federal issue, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts in general about how to go about supporting an industry like oil that is under attack by some environmentalists, but still so important to the region's economy.
Yeah, you know, our Kern County is essentially the top oil-producing county in the United States, and it provides many well-paying jobs and careers. But here's what we know, is that, you know, the fossil fuel industry is going to be replaced sometime in the future with the more sustainable technologies, with the more sustainable technologies like electricity and biomass fuels and hydrogen fuel cells and so on. And so what the state is really doing is saying, hey, that we know that there's going to be this transformation, right? And we need to prepare for the transformation. Meanwhile, we can do the same thing, while also at the same time promoting more of these sustainable technologies to be able to clean up our air and our water. And so it's basically taking a proactive approach to get to the, once again, the sustainable energy sources of the future.
So in our final minutes, I do need to ask about your issues with the IRS. In 2017, a lien was assessed against you and your wife. That lien has been paid back. But at the time, you said you were a victim of bureaucratic incompetence. Now you're in the process of paying back another lien of $145,000. What's going on?
Well, I can tell you this. I'm very proud of the businesses I've created. And we've created over 1,000 jobs. And unfortunately, starting businesses comes with some risk. And some years you do really well, some years you don't. And you work with the IRS to set up a plan to pay back what you owe, which is, you know, a route that thousands of Americans take each and every day. And so, and that's what we're in the process of doing. There's, by no means are we shirking that responsibility, and it's, you know, set up in due course to be able to, you know, pay that back. And I think it's really unfortunate this is being used to muddy the waters. You know, when my opponent, Mr. Valadao, has had his own tax liens in the past, and he walked out on $325,000 that he owed to his workers in his bankruptcy while he was making $1 million a year.
Well, Congressman Cox, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.